All right, we're going to get started, and I think we're only missing one person. I think Jimmy is still out of the room, but he'll be back. He'll be back, I'm confident. Come on in. Now, for those of you that are new, I'm not going to introduce our panelists. You can get the recording. By the way, every recording, you can go and order the CDs of any session of any topic, and you can buy the CD. But I think in a few weeks, everything about the lectureship is on the website. It's all free. You can download it. You can listen to it. Go back and listen to the first session if you want. I will say we have Leon Barnes with us, preacher at the Central Church. Sam Billingsley, he's a shepherd at College Church and a licensed counselor. We have Kathy Heppenstill that teaches here at Harding, and she is deeply involved in social work. We've got Jimmy Hinton that preaches in Somerset, Pennsylvania, and he did a couple of sessions this morning. I've heard some good things. And then Steve Black, who is also here, and he has a book. Tell us the name of your book again.
What Kind of Watchman Are You?
What Kind of Watchman Are You? And your booth is where?
It's in the Benson, in between the men's and ladies' room and the lobby.
Okay, it's in the lobby of the Benson. He's got an excellent book that I think many of you might be interested in. And I'm going to start in this session with Leon Barnes. And one of the things that we were talking about at the end of the first, some of us were, and I can tell you as a church leader, I only want positive PR for the church. I don't want negative. I don't want there to be accusations and all. And so I know that there would be a tendency to not bring up subjects just because we want everyone to feel good and positive about us. So I've asked Leon because he has been in ministry for a long, long time, and he's experienced virtually everything that you can think about, to talk about when you know someone who is a risk or someone who is an offender, the temptation to say, well, we're about propriety. I know even our fellowship is, you know, and there's just certain topics we don't talk about at the Thanksgiving table, you know, and that's kind of the way we feel about church. It's just certain topics that we're not comfortable to bring up. And so there's not so much that we want to sweep it under the rug, but let's just not make a big deal of it so that people won't have the wrong feeling about us. And I've asked Leon to kind of address a little bit about that.
Good question, good topic. And it is so true. You don't want to deal with that. And for most of my years, long before I even knew about all of the right ways you were supposed to handle this, I usually would go to the person one-on-one and say, hey, here's what I'm noticing. And if I sometimes would carry Wade Pohl, who's worked with me now for 112 years, he would usually go with me, and we would sit down with the person and say, you know, we know the situation, know what's happened, and here's what you can do, and just lay it out very clearly to him individually, or that one I'm thinking about right now. And it worked for a little bit. Wasn't long till we noticed him actually becoming very friendly with a lady that had a teenage daughter, and it wasn't long till that daughter was calling to say there was something going on. And so we had to go back to him and say, hey, we know what's happened. You're not welcome here anymore. And wherever you go, we're going to tell that story, what's happened here. And we did. But it did happen again later. I've lost contact now. I don't know what's happened to him. But I know that it did happen in the next church as well. So there is a huge need for us as churches to be very open. Jimmy mentioned this. But, you know, over the years, it's amazing how many churches and preachers I've known that did things wrong sexually, but the elders would very quietly let them go, and when another church would call to say, hey, what about old brother so-and-so? What kind of guy is he? Oh, you know, he's a good guy. Well, you're lying like a dog. Don't do that. You need to tell exactly what's going on and what's happened, because just about every time that I've known of this happening, the person went somewhere else and did the same thing. And it's just crazy how many times I knew a guy that grew up in the same hometown that I did in Alabama. And I know personally of five churches where he worshiped that every one of them, he got involved with some woman in the church or some child in the church. And every single time, the congregation would hide it and not pass that knowledge on. And, you know, I just don't believe God's going to hold them guiltless over that kind of thing. That's you're just as wrong and are harming people in the future. And so someone like that needs to be stopped in their tracks immediately and not let it go any further than that. I do believe that we all, I know that, you know, it's taken me a long time to realize you do need to be more open about this to the whole church. Throughout most of the years, I've either tried to do it or do it with the elders and thus keep it quiet in the congregation. And even though we would pass that word on to others, I've realized that's not nearly far enough. And we need to do a far better job than that. We're at a downtown church, and so we have a lot of things, and maybe we deal with this more than some. But I'm going to tell you, I doubt there's many churches that don't have some problem in that area. So it is a topic we need to be serious about.
Anybody else like to respond to some?
Sure. I agree wholeheartedly. I mentioned earlier deception. Got to have deception in order to be able to do this. In my own experience, again, not in ministry, I'm the strange one. I'm not the Bible major. I'm not the social work major. I'm not the psychology major. But I know this stuff. I can say in the particular instance that spurred a lot of the work that I do, we knew, or some people knew, of the problem. Didn't tell us. Then the problem happened. Okay, well, we need to get this out. Oh, no. We're going to stay quiet. We're going to stay quiet about it. Okay. Well, sure enough, 6 weeks later, person offends again. It doesn't stop by keeping it quiet. This is something that has to be met head on.
So we get to a few more. Anybody have a question that they'd like to raise? Go ahead. Okay. So we have a foster family with a child who is attending the same church where there is a registered offender. What do you do? All right. Anybody want to?
What state are you from?
Texas. Okay. Okay. Here's our Texas expert.
No, what I would say is that every state's going to have that a little bit of a different slant. I work very closely with the Department of Human Services in Arkansas, and I'm not aware of that specific. It's just supervision. They would call it just, again, universal precaution of supervision, and children need to be with people that you trust or rely on. So I think that's a very difficult. I mean, did y'all ever have that experience? I don't know that that's applicable in Arkansas as an issue, but either of y'all have. Okay. So that would just be, I think that in that situation, it would be a nice policy to have that if you have foster children, maybe those people are particularly alerted or whatever. I don't know. But it's a little bit of a slippery slope. But this is why we don't have a lot of prosecutions for sex offenders, is because of the deception and because of the niceness and because of the, you know, friendly PR campaigns. We want to just keep it all quiet. This is why we can't get what we, and I want to just to piggyback off what you said earlier about the counts and the gross charges that get dwindled down, because one of the issues about offenders is you don't want to put a child on the stand. And so to save the child from testifying, they bleed down the charges.
Which saves the offender.
But exactly. And so to prevent persecuting the child or traumatizing the child further, because every offender has the right to be, you know, cross-examined. So all of that's just a big issue of why we don't have a lot of prosecutions is, number one, we don't have a litmus test, and number two, it's people don't come forward, and number three, nobody wants to put a child through testifying. That's what I wanted to follow up just really quick on an earlier comment that was asked about the paranoia discussion. I'm a mom, two kids, and I've been in child welfare for over 25 years. And I think that if we take the taboo out of sexuality and we're all paranoid about sexual molestation and all of that stuff, if we think about it in terms of driving a car, is anybody paranoid really about driving a car from here to here or here to there or putting people in cars with other people? It's so every day that we've become very desensitized. We're not paranoid about driving cars, but cars kill. I mean, we could die in a car very easily. We could be in church service and there'd be a random shooting, and we're not paranoid about attending church services. So we have to sort of put it into a context of what we can deal with. We are not God. We cannot predict and prevent any and every single circumstance that could happen to our children. We do the best we can, and we pray a lot. And then if something happens, then we deal with it. We can't predict and we can't prevent cancer, but we do the best we can, and then we deal with whatever happens. And so those are just some correlations that I wanted to just kind of share with the idea about how do you manage paranoia. I do not let my children, or didn't let my children, spend the night with people except maybe two their whole life. And I was still rolling the dice on them. So you just deal with it, whatever happens, because we do not have the gift of foreknowledge.
Now, Sam is on the board at Searcy Children's Home, so he deals a lot with foster parents and families. Is there anything you want to add to all that? I put you on the spot.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add. It's just that the awareness. We have foster parents in here who may have more experience than I've had. You know, the thing of paranoia is one of them that I just kind of keep thinking about. You know, we don't want people to be paranoid, but we also need to increase the awareness. And I think being in Searcy's basically a small town, and we are so trusting. And sometimes I think that our parents and even some of our Bible class teachers are almost, because we haven't had an incident, and I mentioned the fellow Long a while ago, and had someone in the audience who actually was in the jail when he died, and had to watch over him and see the things that he did. You know, we were much more paranoid when we were dealing with him because we were very defensive and alert. And now, because we haven't had a major incident in several years, you know, we tend to let the guard down and not be as defensive. And so I think we have to keep working at keeping people aware that we have a policeman now that is at our church every service. Why? Because we had some people for a little while who were walking the halls that we didn't know, looking in at children, and we became very conscious of, okay, what could they be doing?
Paranoid.
Now that we have had a policeman there for a year, we haven't had anything happen. So we think, oh, we no longer have a problem.
Uh-huh. Well, we don't have a problem because we took some action. And there's a police car sitting in front of the building, and there's a man in a uniform walking around, and so people are aware. But as far as the foster care, I don't know. Any of you that do foster care know if there's any other?
I'm not sure about a law. Obviously, if you're a foster parent, you need to take care of that child as if they're your own. So there's a law that says that you would be protecting them as you would any of your other children. So obviously, a registered offender cannot be a foster parent, obviously. Can you prevent that, Mr. Storrs? No. Can you prevent that wherever you are?
Yes. Yeah, it's a growing ministry. I know at College Church, more and more of our parents are getting into that and all. And churches, you have to kind of look at your own facility and everything. Like Sam will tell you, we've got, when Bible class starts and the kids are in their classes, we actually, at the ends of halls, the doors get shut and they're locked. And I found out a few weeks ago, I don't have a key to one of those doors. I tried to go down a hallway, and I'm jiggling. I can't even get in there. But I think that there are churches that can look and see what are some extra steps that we take in order to be a little more protective. Jimmy, I'm going to ask you to come now. And how would a church respond if a child in your church has been sexually abused inside the congregation? Tell us how should a church respond when they hear about this?
Yeah, we actually had that with my own dad. He had produced victims inside of our congregation, as well as one a block over from us. We're the a cappella Church of Christ, and then across the street is First Christian. And so he actually had one foot in our church and one foot in the other and was producing victims in both the congregations at the same time. So it's not enough to have, you know, your victims in one church. You got to do it and double up and actually triple, quadruple up. He was doing it all over the place. And he was a professional manny. So he made it a profession to take care of kids. At the same time, he was abusing kids at church. So he's literally using every single avenue that he possibly could to produce as many victims as he possibly could. When you find out that you have survivors, which, by the way, conservatively, very conservatively, in any one of your congregations, whether it's a church of 30 people or 30,000 people, you have very conservatively inside of your congregation 40% of the people sitting in the pews who've been sexually assaulted as a child. And that's a conservative number. When I go and travel places, everywhere that I speak, there have been no exceptions. There's always a line of people waiting to tell me their stories, and most of those people who are telling me their stories, they're telling it for the first time ever. My question is this: why have we not created a culture in the church where people feel safe enough to tell us that they've been sexually abused. The question is, why are they coming to me and telling me their horror stories and not telling their ministers, their elders, their deacons? You know, we've not created a culture. We've created a culture, ironically, which is incredibly safe and warm and welcoming. And how do we build up? How do we take care of the offender? If we're not protecting our kids from known predators, we're inviting them into our congregations, and 40% of the people in the pews who've been terrorized. It is not light touching that we're talking. I mean, you can tell horror stories. I'm guessing you have a very warped sense of humor by this point. Yeah. So it's one of the coping mechanisms when you hear this stuff. You just have a really weird, twisted sense of humor. That's one of our ways to cope with the things that we hear. It's horrible, guys. It is really, really horrible what these guys are doing to these children. And so we've got to shift the culture where we say, we're not going to ignore the survivors and then publicly parade, you know, their predators in front of the congregation and say how forgiving we are and we're loving. And I'm not, believe me, I'm not against forgiveness and I'm not against grace and I'm not against mercy. Don't mishear me. But we have what my co-founder calls misplaced sympathies. We have misplaced sympathies. And so we've got to realize our theology has to be right. And at the very center of God's heart bends very strongly towards those who've been oppressed. God's heart bleeds for those who are bleeding. In fact, there's a scripture where God collects the tears of people. And he writes every tear in his book. Tears are precious to God. God absolutely loves and adores and cherishes people who've been wounded, who've been broken. Look at Jesus' ministry. Jesus' ministry was not ministering to the oppressors, it was ministering to the oppressed. So God's heart, the center of God's heart, is bent towards the survivors. So knowing that we have 40% of the people in our pews that at any given time are not hearing a word that we're saying as preachers, they're literally not hearing a word that we're saying through their own pain and brokenness and identity crises and all that. Knowing that, what we've got to do, and I think the very first thing and probably the most important thing, is cultivate a culture where we talk about it and we tell survivors, you will be safe in this congregation. To answer your question, we just have a blanket policy. It's written in the policy. And Lou, you asked about a template of, I have a template of a policy at Church Protect. If anybody wants that, shoot me off an email or just let me know. I'll give you a copy of that template. We have written into that policy that anybody who's a known convicted child sexual offender is not going to be in the mixed company of children in any context. And so what? And then we say, for worship, that doesn't exclude you from worship. That excludes you from worship with children. There's a reason for that. That's not being mean. There's a very good reason for that. And so what we'll do is create an alternative worship service that's adult only, that still gives them and provides them every opportunity that the rest of us are getting in worship, but without the kids. So that's, I think, probably, because you could get into foster kids, then you could get, I mean, you could get into 70 different avenues real quick for people that are going to be triggered by sex offenders. No, reluctantly no, and here's why. Not all sex offenses are created equal. You have young, they call themselves this in prison, young and dumb. And so those are the ones, you know, the 19-year-old guy who has a freshman or a sophomore in high school girlfriend, they're having sex together, and the mom of the female, usually is how it goes, finds out, gets upset, calls the police. The guy's now a registered sex offender. When he gets out of prison, it just shows up as a registered sex offender. And most people don't really investigate, so they think, oh, he's a pedophile. In group therapy, that guy's going to be tremoring in the corner, because my co-founder experienced this over the years working in prison. These guys would be sobbing when they're hearing the stories of the pedophiles who are not only telling their stories of sexually offending the minor children, but they're laughing about it. They think it's great, and so they're all registered sex offenders. So, you know, we distinguish in our policy, and we say pedophilic sex offenders are the ones that we'll separate. If you've the medical definition of pedophilia is prepubescent. There's a bunch of criteria, but anybody who is a prepubescent child at the time that they were sexually offended, those people with a conviction will never be in the mixed company of kids, regardless of their tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, or 4 status.
Now it goes to trial and he's somehow convicted. Now as he is going off to prison, she admits that it did not happen. And that she lied about that.
Yeah.
So how do you tell, and how do we as you, as those of us in here, are youth ministers who are going into that, how do we keep from getting our own paranoia where
yeah.
You know, how do I protect myself in this? You know, I know I'm not, this is not who I am.
Yeah, I'll say a couple things quickly because I want to make sure I leave time for everybody else, but I'm sure you can speak to that too. Number one, false reports are incredibly rare. They happen, but they are incredibly rare. Combine that with how difficult it is to get a conviction for somebody who we know offended kids, somebody who confesses to it. It's still, even if they confess to it, it's really difficult to get a conviction. It took a lot to get my dad in prison. I mean, it took a lot to get in that man. I mean, it was unreal how much evidence there was. And so the smoking gun was his hard drive that had, he was producing child pornography with these little girls, all sisters, abusing them at the same time. He was producing child pornography that was on his hard drive. So forensics got that. That was the smoking gun. Had they not had that, they told us, Even with that evidence, they said, right now it's a 50-50 whether he's going to get a conviction. We were told that as a family. So the other side of that is it's incredibly common for victims of abuse to rescind or recant their confessions and say, well, I just made it up. There are a lot of reasons for that. One is intimidation. The level that the abusers are intimidating them, and that's something that we don't see because we see the facade that's on the outside. So what I do to find out and kind of ease my own mind, I profile. So that's, for me, it's, I would be able to tell if somebody, most likely. Now, I'm not saying it's 100% guaranteed. I'm not that arrogant to think that. But you know, through my assessment tool, I'm going to be able to find if somebody has a groomer-type personality, he's a male, he's a pedophile, does he fit this criteria? If he fits my criteria, then I'm gonna know the real story pretty quickly. It's a really sticky subject, but it is incredibly rare for people to give false accusations. That's right. Yeah.
So the law says it's being a mandated reporter, it's about suspicion of it. So when we start putting ourselves in the position of saying, I think that guy, he may not be the guy. You know, maybe this is one of those false ones. And what we've done is as we respond to that person that disclosed to us, we're the most powerful person in that process. Disclosed to your youth minister. That's how powerful you are. If you do anything like, now, what are you talking about? Brother Jones, are you sure?
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you. I'm going to ask Steve now to come, and then we'll after him we'll ask some more questions from the audience. But one of the emails that you sent to me, you talked about flying monkeys. I want you not. We've all seen Wizard of Oz, so we kind of have a picture in our mind about flying monkeys. But tell us what that has to do with sexual abuse.
Okay.
partially did that because I figured you couldn't resist.
I could not.
All right. A flying monkey is, I guess for lack of a better term, they're a tool. They are a human being that is being used by the abuser. The term actually comes from a book from Shannon Thomas, Healing from Hidden Abuse. The flying monkey is someone who either had a relationship with the abuser before they started abusing, you know, lifelong friendship, or they're someone that the abuser targets to be their friend. They target this person to be their friend. And although there is no physical component to the abuse, leave no doubt about it, they're abusing this individual psychologically. This is a defense mechanism. The flying monkey is the person, regardless of how much evidence that there is to the contrary, that the person who has an accusation of abuse, no, there's no way. He would never do that. He would never do that. Well, I saw it. No, he'd never do it. A flying monkey is someone that will defend the abuser all the way to the end. And it's sad to see, because when, as this is going on, you can see how the abuser not only abused a child, but the abuser also abused the person who is now doing everything that they can to defend them. But as the evidence piles up, the flying monkey's credibility crumbles.
Anybody else want to respond to anything? Okay. All right.
Question. Now, I think I saw yours next.
Yeah.
Yes, because we've been pretty gender specific up to this point. So how come you guys didn't bring this question up?
So I'm glad you asked that. I was going to jump in a while ago when he was talking and bring this up. But in my forensic interviewing over the years, women are not, and mothers, that's shocking. And so all of this that we're talking about is outside of our framework of our fabric of who we are and everything we understand about life. This changes our worldview to know that A, people can do horrific things to children, A, and B, that it crosses so many taboo ideas that nobody even can come up with it. And I mean, I've done 9 years worth of forensic interviews, and I'm still able to just be brought to my knees thinking I've not heard the worst thing yet. And moms are a part of that. So not only females, but moms. And so again, I'm going to say universal precaution. And I would say if it applies to a man, it applies to a woman absolutely every single time. And it applies to moms as much as it applies to dads, because it's there. It might be there in less statistical numbers, but those statistical numbers may be underreported. And so we have to understand the magnitude of the attachment bond of a child and a caregiver that says, this can't be wrong, it can't be bad, it's got to be normal, it has to be, you know, this doesn't happen to anybody else, so it's got to be, it's just part of apple pie and baseball to some families, and we don't understand how it could be different, but it is. So I'm gonna say absolutely universal precautions, women are just as much at risk.
Anybody else?
One aspect that I would like to mention, that is sometimes the woman isn't the abuser, but she's protecting her husband or the stepdad who is. And many different occasions I've had stepmoms or moms to come to me when their child has made, usually in a Bible class, something, some warning or something has been said about
maybe my dad, and the mom comes to his defense completely and protects him in that whole thing. I had a case back several years ago where the mom had gone to the elders of the church, pleading with them, telling them, you know, this is happening, but I want to be loyal to my husband. And the elders had told her, yes, you need to be true to your husband. And it finally came to me, and I said, no, you need to be true to your kids and get out of that mess and get that bum in jail. So sometimes moms are not the physical abusers, but they're very much a part of it.
All right, I saw some other questions. Go ahead.
Begin to populate a list on the board of what is it that a congregation should be doing and can be doing as far as putting things in place. So, okay, we already heard about policies. Could you put that up? If there are other things from your perspective that you think that congregations should be doing, should elders be having meetings about it?
Okay.
Just put that down on the board so that we could begin to I could probably begin to build a model.
Okay.
Of what each congregation, my congregation, should be doing in light of trying to protect and create policies and all that kind of stuff. Could you please do that?
Anybody like to take that? I'll do the writing if someone will do that right quick.
Could just buy his book.
Yeah, I could. Well, his book and all. Or let's build.
Shout some of them out. Have you write them down?
We'll start with policy, but keep going.
Yeah, so policy, and feel free, people from the audience, too, to jump in here, too, because you are the experts as well. Protection policies, and I would note that policies are only as strong as the people who enforce them. At the end of the day, it's a piece of paper. It's not about a policy. It's about a cultural shift. And we had to experience that in our congregation. Our policy is just a piece of paper. We had to do a radical cultural shift.
Socialism.
All right, social discussion.
Lessons from the pulpit.
All right, in fact, what did you just say before we
open discussion? Open discussion.
Okay, yeah. That's okay, open. And then, you got to make sermons for this. See, that's the thing, we don't.
Yeah.
We'd rather preach Acts 2:38.
Yeah.
The elders should probably do that, don't you think, Noel?
Yes, they should, Sam. All right. Anybody else want to add to this? Lou, Adrian.
We probably faced this in a conversation about 15 years ago.
Yes.
Set the policy and blessing. And one of the things we found is education of the congregation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All these signs that they're mm-hmm. talking about, as far as you can spot these people.
Yes.
We had an annual Saturday where we taught people what to look for. So you've got three members, you've got the congregation, you've got that many eyes looking for these kind of people.
And I'm going to add to that. I'm going to put up here, I'm the dunderhead on this group, I assure you. But I'm going to put in there safe atmosphere. And here's what I mean by that. Sam will tell you, we really look for every single way. We've got 32 cameras that not only look on the outside, but we have 19 entrances at College Church, and there's a camera on every single entrance. So no one gets in, no one gets out. And that is for everybody's protection. So we have cameras, we have an officer, we have talked about a lot of things publicly and all, so that there is an atmosphere that if someone who might be a predator or show some of these signs, they kind of also know that there's people watching and they're going to take action. So I think that you can create we have men that roam, but we have men with walkie-talkies that walk our halls while some others are watching the monitors. And I would say virtually two or three times a month, they go and go find someone that they don't recognize is in a part of the church where they don't need to be. And usually it's, you know, it's not really a big deal, but they, and at least if anything else, they just escort them quickly away from that. But I mean, we've got people, we got men moving, and we just try to put an atmosphere that says to the families, we're doing everything we can, but says to the predator, we're doing everything we can, okay? And that way they know that this may not be a place where they're going to be successful.
One thing I would add to that, though, is that we emphasize the fact that it may not be an outsider.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
We look for the for the person who is your friend,
yes,
who has got this problem, and you were not aware of it. Mm-hmm.
And again, like someone said, it may be the home, but they're not even allowed to do that. Everyone that has any activity at all that has to do with our kids, there's a background check. So, I mean, even that, we tried to take some steps to ensure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like he said, the guy, the brother wasn't registered.
That's true.
So he's saying we got, you know, teach the members how to identify by maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got to be a family, a collective community thing. Yeah.
Notifying the parents. We'll have children, especially if there's someone in the congregation that is an offender, that someone they can be watching for, whether they're inside the congregation or outside the congregation.
See what you got there.
It's relationships. So that we know it's not just in the church, but
yeah,
our
children. Yeah. Yeah.
Family problems.
That's a good point. One of the things that I emphasize is, like, we can make our church is the Titanic and still strike an iceberg. Like, just because we have a safe congregation, like, our culture has to be, the cultural shift has to be, this is a safe place and we're going to give you the tools to make your home a safe place, in the ball field and the playground and everywhere that your kids go. We're going to teach you, we're going to give you the tools to be able to look for this kind of stuff and keep your kids safe, because it's not just about the church building being a safe place.
Go ahead.
In a safe place doesn't just mean cameras and cops. It means,
yeah,
you have to have a congregation that's safe so people can talk about stuff and be paid attention,
yeah,
to, listened to, believed,
yeah,
and not demeaned or blamed.
Yeah.
And Stephen has said, recognizing that family problems become congregation problems. What do you mean by that?
Well, it kind of goes along with what you were just saying. Passivity is a big problem. Recognizing, if you recognize that there's a problem, that's great. But what are you going to do with that information? If you're not willing to speak up whenever you see a challenge, a problem, then passivity is one. And in the illustration of the bad watchman found in Ezekiel 33, that individual has just become a bad watchman. They're willing to let the legs sticking out underneath the bush, they're kind of tiptoeing along up towards the wall, they're letting that go by, as opposed to sounding the alarm, hey, we've got a bush moving, and bushes don't normally move. As far as recognizing that family problems become congregational problems, you know, that individuals make up families. Families make up churches. And as individuals have problems, if these problems aren't dealt with within their family, then the family ends up having a problem. As the family starts having problems, they're a part of a congregation, then you end up having congregational problems. Building that support system where individuals and or families can have that psychological safety where they can speak up and say, hey, I'm having problems with this, or I suspect this, and then know that things will be dealt with, as opposed to it being swept under the rug, is extremely powerful.
And I would add, maybe to some degree, probably most everybody that's in this room, you're here because you want this dealt with. You want this out in the open. We want to be able to talk about this and deal with it in the most appropriate way.
I still remember, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, Adrian, that you spoke at the Shepherding Conference in Little Rock. And Adrian was in a room full of mostly elders and elders' wives, and he was talking about sexual addiction. And I remember that he used a few words that normally they don't hear very much. And their hair is straight back from their head in the beginning because we don't talk about these things. It's not something we do as a family, you know, for whatever reason. Now, by the end of that day, they began to see the need to start confronting a lot of this head on in their congregations, and their hair relaxed a little bit so that they could go home and say, we may have this problem of pornography in our congregation. And so I would say, from your leadership level, is to say, let's not pretend that we're immune to this. Let's go ahead and be this universal precaution. Let's find out what we can do. You want to speak to anything, Andrew?
Tag off of that and what Lou said a second ago, because you used the term cultural change. All the things that we're doing up there on the board, we are baseline, play good defense. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely triage. It's mm-hmm. I'm going to protect you, mm-hmm. defend you. You did nothing wrong. You're a child. You had no choice of this. And then follow through. And I think our follow through is where we get the next step of tripping up. And you talked earlier in this morning, or maybe it was this one, I forget now, about we believe in being redeemed and being forgiven. I'm like, mm-hmm. Of course we
yeah,
do.
Sure.
But that has nothing to do with healing pathology or being rehabilitated or the end of an addiction, et cetera. And I think mm-hmm. a follow-through is something that is part of our American culture. We want it to be really quick. So if you're forgiven, amen, let's go to KFC, everything's okay. But in reality, that's just the beginning
mm-hmm.
of trauma work. When you're sitting there at college church every Sunday and you've got 400 people in there that have been sexually abused,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like that's a pretty significant thing. I don't know mm-hmm. if you can get paranoid over something that significant.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that cultural part mm-hmm. that is, I really appreciate you use the word dark. It's a lot darker than what people think.
Yes.
We think of sexual
okay.
abuse, we think of sex, and what we know of sex,
mm-hmm.
that's not even in the hemisphere of what goes
right.
on with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
So that opposite free, that,
mm-hmm.
you know what, we take on trauma here just like we do exercise and health eating, because it's that common.
Mm-hmm.
That culture.
And Adrian, it's interesting, like I try to figure this out from a minister's perspective. Like, you know, somebody who's in full-time ministry, and we go and consult with churches, and it's just so frustrating because they, like, most of the churches just don't get it, and they're not even talking about the survivors. And so I'm trying to figure out, okay, what would, surely it's not that they don't care about survivors of abuse. And so I'm trying to figure out, as a minister, you know, being objective as I can, what is it? And it comes back to this addiction. We slowly, as ministers, and I mean just Christians in general, we've been conditioned by our culture, and we want this quick, instantaneous fix. And look at our addiction to opioids, and I mean, oh, we have addictions to everything because we can't instantly feel better. And so that creeps into our theology, and we want what I say is our addiction to cardboard testimonies. We want the quick testimonies, and ironically, the predators are the ones who can give that nice, clean, this is who I was, this is who I am now. And the survivors are so frustrated because what in the world do they write on the back of their card? They're constantly in and out of battling eating disorders, drug addictions, sexual promiscuity, intimacy issues, divorce and remarriage. I mean, they're just... A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are just struggling with all these issues. What in the world do they write on the back of their card? And so then we offer the platitudes, which spirals them into this emotional distress and out of the church. And so we say things like, well, you just have a grudge in your heart. You just haven't forgiven your abuser. You need to just pray more. You know, and we offer them platitudes instead of just, I call it sitting on the ash heap with them. It's a terrible place to sit. It's awkward. It's horrible. It's draining. It's emotionally exhausting. And that's exactly where every survivor needs us to be sitting with them.
I'll tag on I'm in absolute agreement with you and Jimmy. There's actually a question that I had given Noel, which was, what is forced forgiveness? And one of the tragedies that we witness whenever we're dealing with this topic is the topic of forced forgiveness. And I'll give you just kind of a brief definition that I have of it and a brief explanation. Forced forgiveness is when you have an offender and their flying monkeys give heavy, heavy doses of Matthew 18 to a survivor and to their family, and then go hide behind the cross. And then as they're hiding behind the cross, if the survivor I'm not saying a very close gathering, but even the proximity of the offender does not act exactly the way that they acted prior to their abuse, then the offender and their flying monkeys jump out from behind the cross and say, "You're unforgiving. You're not a good Christian. You're not following the way that you're supposed to do." And then what happens? The sympathies for the one who deserved the sympathies are taken away, and they are then put onto the offender. I'll give you the personal example now. With my particular situation, it was not, well, I'll put it to you this way. The offender of my child arrived at my doorstep with their hair still wet after baptism. You need to normalize relations with us. You need to straighten out your relationship with me. You need to let me back in the family. As my child was upstairs terrified that this person was even in my house. The abuse happened in my house, and he comes back to my house to tell me that we needed to normalize relations. So then, time goes on. Hey, by the way, we're having this get together, and he's going to be there. No, okay, that's fine. We're not going to be there. You're unforgiving. When we get out of that mindset and we get into the mindset where we recognize that these people can then twist the words of our Lord and Savior and use them against us in this spiritual battle, we begin to see.
Well, thank you. I know you probably have more questions. Will you thank all of our panelists for sharing with us today? Again, Steve's book is in the lobby of the Benson. Any of you others have books? Leon, you don't have any books here, do you? 21 books? Okay. I've colored in most of Leon's books by now. So, but thank you again. And I know that these folks will probably stay around for a few more minutes. So if you still have a question that you really, really want answered, you might come visit with them. But thank you for being here today.